time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for December 21st, 2019. And once again, I'd like to wish everyone a happy holiday season. This week, we have the proverbial smorgasbord of shows. Four guests whose topics range from California, Spain, to Colorado, and finally back to the East Coast. Usually when we think about Patrick Brady, we think red kite, prayer, and road bikes, right? Well, Patrick is wearing a new cap these days. He's the interim executive director of the California Mountain Bike Coalition. In a state so large, with so many different areas in which to ride, there are also a plethora of organizations that manage mountain bike issues. With a new 501c3 designation, the coalition has a new mission: to improve and increase access for mountain biking throughout California by providing a unified, statewide voice for organizations and individuals. We'll find out why Patrick is a great choice to head it up. Then we head to Barcelona, Spain, to speak with race director Manuel Tejada about the Garmin Titan Desert Race. Who knew that upwards of 700 people have been competing through the mountains and dunes of Morocco for a week, followed by an entourage of medical assistance, restaurants, technical support, and a spa-like encampment each night. About to launch its 15th year, the race will also see five-time Tour de France winner Miguel Indurain and his son join the ranks with the hope of just finishing. Then it's back to the U.S. to speak with the director of off-road events for Lifetime Fitness, Michelle Duffy. In the past year, Lifetime has acquired Crusher and the Tusher, Dirty Kanza, and recently announced the new Big Sugar Gravel Race as the organization looks to expand its already big offering of other events. To say that gravel is the thing these days was perfectly illustrated when Big Sugar sold out 4 minutes of when the website opened for registration. Finally, Dennis Mercado Soriano, the executive director of the East Coast Greenway Alliance, brings us up to date on the progress made in 2019 on the 3,000-mile north to south, or if you prefer, south to north, connectors that make walking and biking safer and more enjoyable. So let's get right to it with Patrick Brady. Hey, Patrick, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this week.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much.
So, happy holidays, too. I guess it's coming along that time, December, mid-December, how that's possible. I don't know what happened to 2019.
Me either.
Yeah, I know. I want to talk about your new gig, which is really kind of exciting, although I think when people hear about it, they're going to go, wait, Patrick, Red Kite Prayer, mountain bikes, those are sort of a non sequitur. So let's figure out what it is you are doing. Talk to me about the California Mountain Bike Coalition, I think it's called, right?
Yeah, CAMTB, the California Mountain Bike Coalition. And what the hell is a guy who's mostly been known as a roadie doing with this outfit? Okay, basics. I first rode a mountain bike in 1987. I bought my first mountain bike in the winter of 88, you know, like 2 months later. I was hooked. I had a touring bike, but no road bike. And so I was into mountain bikes before I had, a high-end road bike, really. So I've been into the sport for a very long time. It just happens that most of my career as a rider has been devoted to the road end of the sport. And that all became, it all came about because I joined the staff of Bicycle Guide back in 1996 as one of the editors, and they were an all-road publication. And I just got kind of pigeonholed. And it wasn't until like 2011 with RKP where I realized one day, oh, hang on, I'm the boss. I can write about anything I want. And so I started, you know, I started riding mountain bikes again, and I started writing about the experience. And it's one of those things where when people think of me, I'd really rather they think of me as someone who's cyclophilic. I just like bikes. If it's got two wheels, a handlebar, and pedals, I'm in. I like it. And so seeing this division of, oh, he's just a roadie, it's not really helpful to me or anyone else for that matter. But when I heard that some people I was familiar with, one person I actually knew, when I heard that they were starting an advocacy organization that was actually going to lobby in Sacramento state officials and take on large statewide efforts as opposed to focusing their efforts on regional issues the way the Redwood Empire Mountain Bike Alliance does here in Sonoma County, or STIMBA does down in San Diego, or CORBA does in the LA area, but instead look at what sorts of changes can we make? How can we influence legislation at the statewide level? I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. It's time somebody did this. 40 years mountain biking has existed as a sport. 40 years. And in all that time, California, the birthplace of mountain biking, and by the way, we are the fifth largest economic engine in the entire world. We haven't had a single statewide advocacy organization ever. And you know, it's one of those things where we can kind of position that as a fail, but I think the greater reality is that you consider how big some of the areas are that some of these regional organizations serve. I mean, REMBA here in Sonoma County isn't just Sonoma County. They exist in Napa and they serve Lake County as well. And there's an effort on their part to move into Mendocino County as well. And so that four county area that they would serve is bigger than a lot of states. And I think it's really important to keep in mind, to keep some perspective on this in terms of biting off that level of an effort is huge. And I don't think we can ever fault anyone for saying, I'm just going to do San Diego. I really can't take on the rest of the state. California is a really big place. And it took people who were already intimately involved in advocacy, who already understood the needs, and had this crazy ambition of, well, let's bring all these regional nonprofits under one tent and start finding where the consensus points are, and let's speak on their behalf to Sacramento.
So I guess if you have these sort of different factions around the state and you're going to be sort of the figurehead for them, are you getting any pushback from any of them, or are they all saying this is a good idea?
Some are, shall we say, being a little cautious. You know, haven't fully signed on yet. Later this afternoon, we're going to have a call with the Mountain Bikers of Santa Cruz. That organization has been doing incredible work. They have made such incredible progress in and around Santa Cruz, and one could make the case that maybe they don't need a whole lot of help from anybody else right now. I can't blame them for, you know, asking the question, well, what do you have to offer us? And right now we're in a position where if we're going to bring all these different organizations under one tent and find out how we can serve them, our first job is just to listen. We've got to listen to what the needs are. They change from Butte County to San Diego County. It's not all the same thing. But I think we're going to find theme and variation. And I think we're going to find a lot of points that are common to everyone, where fundamentally our slogan is more trails, better trails. It's that simple. We exist to create more trails and better trails that will serve a great many people beyond just the mountain bikers that you and I know and ride with and, well, are.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Patrick Brady. When we usually talk with him, we're talking about the work he does with his organization, Red Kite Prayer, which is one of the most popular blogs, and you have a podcast, as does pretty much everybody these days. I feel like an old lady. well,
You're
I am an old lady,
Diane.
But... Huh?
You're a leader, Diane. You're ahead
thanks.
Of the curve.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I do appreciate that. But I'm really kind of interested in following what you're doing, because I think that the more organized and the more cohesive the voice of whatever organization it is, it's better off at that legislative level. So what are some of the things that you're hoping to accomplish, let's say in the short term in 2020?
This organization is still so new. We got our taxpayer ID number 10 days ago or
okay.
something. We're so new that we're still establishing just what our agenda is. Our first year is going to be a whole lot of listening. There'll probably be a few efforts. My job right now isn't to decide what those efforts are. That's why we have a board. My job initially is to make sure that people are even aware that this organization exists. And then beyond that, I have to go make friends. I have to introduce this organization to big industry leaders. You know, I need to go talk to Specialized. I need to talk to Giant. I need to talk to Trek. And that's the sort of thing where having a familiar face saying, this is something that we need, it's time we did this, is going to be helpful to them. And it's hard for me to explain the shift in my own life. I can admit that 15 years ago, my desire in cycling was to be part of a small cycling team, a bunch of masters racers who went out and kicked butt in local races and had a lot of fun. That's what I wanted. I wanted an intimate group of people who all knew what they were doing on the bike. I didn't want to be the guy who was absolutely teaching everyone how to fix a flat and, you know, what it was to climb out of the saddle. And yet, what, 9 years ago? I'm not even sure. I came out with a how-to book for entry-level road cyclists, the no-drop zone. And part of that journey has led me to this point where I really feel an obligation to speak up on behalf of my sport, to help to advocate. And one of the most critical places in terms of need and access and a real need for a voice is within advocacy for mountain bikes. And this isn't something that just affects the flat bar set. This has an impact on gravel riders as well. So at a certain level, I don't care who you are, there's a good chance that if you're riding in California on unpaved surfaces, that CAMTB has the potential to help you ride in new places. And that's really our whole goal. We want to open up more of the state. We want to decrease user conflict. And one of the ways you do that is you build more trails. You spread people out throughout a park. And so there's so much opportunity here. And there's been so much effort on the part of mountain bikers to figure out how to build new trails, build better trails, build that are more sustainable, build trails that are more fun.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a second and back up into something you said about the people you are going to contact, the Specialized, the Treks, the Giants, those people. What about some of the small, and when I say small, specifically U.S. builders and makers like Paul Components and CSIP and some of the people who build bikes at NABS. I mean, you're the chief judge at NABS. I imagine you're still going to be doing this. How could they contribute to this, and what could you maybe give back to that community?
Well, the first thing to do is to be cognizant of what is a reasonable ask when I go and sit down with someone. It's reasonable for me to ask for a check from Specialized.
That's true.
It's not as reasonable for me to drive up the road to Jeremy CSIP and sit down with him and say, Jeremy, I need you to send me a check or let me leave with a check. Jeremy's ability to help us is much more on the PR side of things and lending his faith and his credibility to to our effort and say, I believe in these guys. I support them. You should too. That's where these other more boutique-y brands that don't move through $1 billion in a couple of years. I want to be sensitive to what they're able to do and also sensitive to where they really can do the most good. And, you know, some people need to do heavier lifting. Some people get to do it in a little more stylish way.
I love it. That's awesome. So when will you have more information in terms of a website and how to find out more and how to either get involved if people want to get involved? I imagine you're not going to turn away people who say, I want to help or I want to work on trails, or you'll have your different parts of your coalition. When will people be able to find out about it, or can they find out now, and how would they contact you?
Probably the first easiest way to catch up with us is on Facebook, CAMTB.org.
Okay.
So they can find us there. We're on Instagram. We do have a website already, CAMTB.org. And there's a new website on the way. There's some pointing issues right now in terms of, you know, DNS stuff and whatnot. But CAMTB.org is where the site, once it's fully fleshed out, will live.
Yes, it will. I see it now as she types it in. Very nice. Well, Patrick, I wish you a lot of luck. I know you are the interim executive director. Do you hope to stay with them?
I'd really like to. I'd like to find a way to be a part of this in a long-term capacity. I really believe in the work, and it's something that I would like to show my sons, you know, is a great way to serve your community.
Well, I wish you and your family a very happy holidays. We will post the CAMTB information on our Facebook page. I appreciate you talking with me and being, I hope, one of the first people to talk about this with you, because you sent me the message last week, and that was pretty exciting.
Thank you so much. I'm beyond grateful for this. I really am. And happy holidays to you and yours.
Okay. Take care, Patrick. We'll talk again.
Thanks.
Bye. Patrick Brady, the interim executive director of the new California Mountain Biking Coalition, joined me to talk about the organization. If you'd like more information, you can log on to CAMTB.org. We're going to take a short break and come back to speak with Manuel Tejada about the 15th running of the Desert Titan Race coming up in April. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. When I heard that Miguel Indurain was going to get on a mountain bike, ride 3,000 kilometers through the deserts and mountains of Morocco, is now 55 years old, I thought, this should be interesting. Here is my conversation with ride director Manuel Tejada. Hello, Manuel. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me today.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be with you. So let's talk about the Titan Desert.
Yes, let's do that. So I received notice that Miguel Indurain was going to race the Desert Mountain Bike event, and I thought this is a great story. So the first thing I'd like to know is a little about the Titan Desert Race and a little bit about you. Tell us.
Okay, so while about me, I am the cycling manager in RPM Marketing, that is a company based in Barcelona. We are specializing in sport events like the Marathon of Barcelona, Half Marathon of Barcelona, and I am in charge about all of the cycling events. And about the Titan Desert, in 2006, we started with this race that we call like the Rally Dakar of mountain biking. It's a mountain bike race by stages in the Morocco desert. And we started with 4 days of race, and now we are racing 6 days. And it's in a special race in the world because we have the part of mountain biking, but also an important part of navigation with the GPS. And, well, we receive like 20, 25 countries each year in our race. And, well, I think it's one of the, maybe the most important, the most famous, or the second one mountain bike stage race.
Well, it's going on 15 years old, which is an older race, and I'm surprised I didn't know more about it. And I'm really excited that I'm learning more about it. So tell me where the race starts and ends. And I know it goes through some really rugged terrain.
It's about the terrain. It's desert, but not very sandy, because in the desert you find a lot of mountains and rocky tracks. And we have like 2-3 stages in the mountain, and after we move to the desert with 1 day in the dunes. Not so many kilometers in the dune, but next to the dune, so it's the more sandy day. And after the last day, it's shorter, about 60-70 kilometers for the last stage. And one important thing about the race, different than the others, is the camp, because all of the competitors, all of the people of the staff, the journalists, all of us, we live in a bear camp that move each day from one place to another, where you can find the hospital, the press room, the restaurants, the place to spend the night. And it's like a big town that is moving from one day to another.
Wait, so you actually pick up all of the facilities? So I saw there were tents. I mean, it's a very nomadic type race, so everything moves with the riders.
Yeah, well, it's true that we build up the camp like 1 week before in every location, so it's not the same camp. The tents are different in the day 1, 2, and 3. But we move some of the facilities, like the hospital or the bike racks. The bike racks we move from 1 day to another. But the restaurant, the tents, and the main facilities of the camp are different from one place to another, because it's not possible to build up in the same day.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking, and I hope I get this right, with Manuel Tejada. Is that pronounced correctly, Manuel?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Good girl. Anyway, from the Titan Desert event, and this just sounds like such an amazing event, and not one that I would be capable of doing. And I wanted to ask you, are there any women who race?
Yeah, sure. Right now, for the 20 and 20 edition, we have 40 women already entry. And 2 years ago, we have our record, our most powerful women entries. We have 18 of 39, and the total were like 70 women who took part in our race 2 years ago. But normally they are around 40, 50 women in race.
And how many participants altogether?
Yeah, we are talking about 700,
wow.
650, depends on the year. But our sold out is 700.
Wow, that's a lot of riders to take care of for 6 days. I've been a ride director, and it's hard. So this is a timed event. It is a competitive event, so there's a winner?
Yeah, it's a competitive event. It's a race. We have the final order. It's a podium. There is a podium. There is the leader jersey. It's a race, it's true, but I like to say that it's also an adventure. It's a personal challenge, because like 100 or 120 people, they come for the race by but the rest are coming about the adventure, about riding their bikes on the desert, living 1 week like a nomad, and maybe meeting people with the same feelings and likes from different parts of the world.
It just sounds like such an amazing race. And if you look at the website, and we'll give you that information before we sign off. If you look at the website, there's a wonderful video and a lot of information. You have a huge sponsor. Garmin is your main sponsor. So that's why everything is through GPS. Yes.
Yeah, we are working with Garmin like, I think, six, seven years ago. In the beginning, we were using the roadbooks, like the motorbikes, paper roadbooks. But after Garmin joined with us, we started using the tracks in the GPS devices. And it's nice because people can design their own tracks, just checking in the checkpoints and in the feed station. And if they want to ride alone in the desert or trying to find the fastest route, they can design their own tracks or just following our routes, our tracks. That's a part, it's a different part of the race from the other races.
Sounds so interesting. And I know you have a huge group of journalists. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to be there, but that would be so much fun. So I guess we should talk about your big celebrity. Miguel Indurain is coming this year, 2020, and he says his goal is to finish. Now, he's 55 years old. Of course, he's won the Tour de France 5 times. How did he decide to come do? Well, he's also from Spain, right? That's how.
It's easy because Miguel is a really good friend of Melchior Mauri. Melchior Mauri is a winner in 2007, but he was also a winner of La Vuelta, the Tour of Spain. So they are friends, they are in contact, and like 1 year ago, Melchior talked to Miguel. They went on a dinner, and I think that with some glass of wine, and Melchior talked to him about the Titan Desert, and well, he combines Indurain to come with his son. Miguel will be with his son, that is called also Miguel Indurain Jr., and they will be with us for this next Titan Desert.
These are mountain bikes, so Miguel Indurain is not a mountain bike racer per se, but you are riding. Are they full suspension bikes? I didn't even ask that.
Miguel will be the first time in a mountain bike race. And like 1 week ago, 10 days ago, I was having lunch with Miguel and I asked him about what kind of mountain bike he is going to take part with us. And right now, he didn't know which is a hard trail, full suspension. He didn't know yet, but it doesn't matter. I think he's in shape and he will do a great race.
What do you recommend people bring?
Double suspension.
Yeah, sure.
Like 100 millimeters of travel, mountain bike like Specialized Epic or Cannondale, the Cannondale with double suspension or Scott Spark. But most of the competitors came with us in the Specialized Epic, and the second brand is the Scott Spark.
According to the website, there's 129 days, 20 hours, and 15 minutes left. And I assume that's before the race starts.
The race is in April. We have the scrutineering in the 18th. First stage will be 19th of April. And the last day, the stage number 6, the 2024.
So if people are interested, they can go to Titan Desert, TitanDesert.com. The website is amazing. There are lots of videos and photos. There's the history of the race. You can learn about registration and some of the news. And the adventure itself just looks so interesting. I love that part of the world, and I wish we could be there. Manuel, thank you so much for talking with me. I hope you have a great race this year. I assume the weather's just going to be hot and dry.
Okay, so thank you. And as you have told before, we have a journalist program, not for riding. We have some cars around the 4x4 cars around the race, and maybe it's a good option for you if you want to come with us to discover and know how the Titan Desert is.
Oh, thank you for that invitation. It sounds fabulous. And I wish you lots and lots of luck. We will watch the race. I want to ask one other question, and that's about the broadcast schedule. A lot of people will be broadcasting this event. And in fact, there is a list of official broadcasters. But I'm not really seeing who's going to broadcast it in the U.S., if anybody.
I think that we have the social media, we have the YouTube channel, we have Instagram, and you can follow, people will be able to follow the race through our social media. But after the race, we have a program like 26 minutes that we broadcast in more than 100 countries. And I think that through Fox, you will be able to watch the 26 minutes program of the Titan Desert 2020.
Is that every single day, or is that at the end of the sixth stage?
We have in Spain, we have a program each day, like 12, 14 minutes. It's very about the sport, about the stage, about who is the winner, just about the classification. And the last one, the 26 minutes, is after the stage, and talk more about the adventure and the challenge.
Well, thanks again, and we will be watching the Titan Desert Race, and we'll watch Miguel Indurain get on a mountain bike. That's going to be interesting in itself. Thanks so much, Manuel. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You're welcome, and keep in contact. Bye.
I absolutely will. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Manuel Tejada joined me from the offices of Desert Titan in Barcelona, Spain. Yes, I really do wish I could go and be part of the press corps. What a treat that would be. But if you'd like to know more, or perhaps this is an event you'd like to conquer, you can log on to titandesert.com. There you can see videos, learn about the history, and get news and registration information. So let's take another short break before we talk with Michelle Duffy from Lifetime Fitness about gravel races. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Lifetime Fitness was just another gym, a place to work out, swim, take a class or two. But nope. Founder Baham Akradi has a vision to change lives, and that vision includes producing spectacular events such as Dirty Kanza, Big Sugar, and Leadville. Michelle Duffy is the director of these outdoor off-road events. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, Diane. Happy to be here.
Well, happy holidays, first of all. It is that time of year. So I hope you and your family are going to have a wonderful holiday. I know you're in Colorado. Lots of snow?
It's coming. We have a lot of snow in the mountains right now, so it looks beautiful.
Yeah, we have snow too, but it's not so beautiful. Anyway, that's a different story here in Cleveland. This isn't exactly ski country, not downhill anyway. Anyway, let's talk about Lifetime Fitness. It is Lifetime Fitness. Let's talk about the races that they've acquired. Garmin's Dirty Kanza, which is probably one of the toughest gravel races in the U.S. The Crusher Race in Utah. And you just announced a new race in Bentonville, Arkansas, the Big Sugar, which I talked with Bike Snob about a few weeks ago. So I did know it was coming. Tell me a little bit about why Lifetime got involved in these big gravel events.
Yeah, sure. So it actually really comes from our senior leadership and passion. So Lifetime's a giant company. We own gym-style clubs around the country, but we also own a little over 30 events right now, and recently been really diving in on the gravel side. Our founder and CEO, Bram Akradi, he acquired the Leadville Race Series back in 2011, again, through passion. I mean, he's finished 10 Leadville 100s, and our senior VP of events holds the record for the most sub-8-hour finishes in Leadville. So it started there, and then as we've seen this shift in gravel, we want to connect with the cycling community, and we've seen such a shift off of the roads lately. We're lucky enough that we have the means as this giant company to be able to put on large scale events. So that's our focus is really on putting on large scale fun experiences, and right now that focus is really gravel.
Well, you certainly picked the two of the biggies, the Crusher Tusher, Crusher and the Tusher, which is hilarious.
Yes.
And then Dirty Kanza. So, but Bentonville, Arkansas, what do you think brought up that particular location? I know it's the home of Walmart, and I know they're involved in cycling. Was there any connection there?
I think it's more the latter there, the community. When we've been looking at what communities we want to be a part of, Emporia, where Dirty Kanza is an easy one because, well, one, they've done an amazing job, the team out there who's still part of our team. They're part of the Lifetime team now. Just their community has surrounded and embraced that event, and we were looking for something similar when we were going to greenfield a new event. So we didn't just want to acquire. We also wanted to be able to put on an experience of our own and grow up from the ground up. And we didn't want it just another community that had great gravel. We wanted a community that we thought would rally around the event, is already thriving within the cycling community, and Bentonville really does a great job of that. Amy Ross leads up Bike Bentonville out there, and she reached out to our team to say, you know, come down, check it out. We have really great gravel roads, and it was perfect timing because we were already starting to scope out the scene there. So as soon as we went down, things just kind of fell into place. And then the other thing is Bentonville, similar to Emporia, Kansas, is it has a really good, like, homegrown grassroots feel. And we want to make sure that wherever we do an event, we want to make sure that it's true to gravel. So those things are super important, like community, a grassroots feel, super down-to-earth people. So Bentonville kind of fits the mark there.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Michelle Duffy. She has a position with Lifetime that works with these gravel events. You're a marketing director for gravel. Is that the right term?
Yeah, I'm the marketing director for all of our off-road events. So it would also include the Leadville Race Series events and Schwamigan.
Leadville. That's another whole topic.
Yeah.
When you said that your founder had completed all these Leadvilles, I'm thinking, okay, now I understand why he's into, like, gravel. There was a piece that I read, I think it was on the Lifetime website, about the women's camp, the DK women's camp, which is Dirty Kanza, and your preparation for it. So tell us a little bit about what you did to prepare for this extreme gravel event.
Sure. I actually grew up a runner, ran through college and post collegiately. And as of late, I found myself getting deeper and deeper into the marketing side of cycling. And as I've gotten deeper in that, I think I've learned a lot about the consumer, but I've also learned that there's a lot of barriers to get into the sport. And so as we've been looking to get more women on the bike and not just participating in events, but just riding in general, we discovered I was in this unique position where I wasn't really a cyclist yet. So I could go through knowing what we were trying to fix and figure out what some of those barriers were. So the Dirty Cans of Women's Camp was the first real test there. And it was started by Christy Moan, who's one of the original Dirty Kansas crew and became a part of the Lifetime team through the acquisition. And if you don't know her, she's been spearheading women's initiatives within the gravel cycling community for a few years now. It dates back to a couple years ago when she did the 200 Women, 200 Miles campaign out at Dirty Kansas. And she started a women's camp for women to really have like a, it's not necessarily for beginners, but it's more to have a safe space to ride hard with other women and learn off the bike in an environment where you're not afraid to ask questions. And so I think I had 3 weeks to prepare for that. And we covered, 150 miles or something across those 3 days, including a gravel event and then 3 days of riding. So it was a blast. There was around 25 women there. We kind of capped the weekend off with an event called Bleeding Kansas. It's a gravel duro event in Manhattan, Kansas.
Very interesting. So would you say that women racing gravel is a growing part of the sport?
Definitely, but there's still opportunity to grow. I think as of late, we've been seeing a lot of race organizers, ourselves included, finding ways to give women a platform and an opportunity to get in. But there is already an appetite. We're just learning a lot about the female consumer. They wait a little bit longer than a male would. And as gravel event registration is trending high, using Big Sugar as an example, that event sold out in 4 minutes. And it does typically take women a little bit longer to pull the trigger on an event. They're socializing with their friends, seeing if others want to commit. Do they have somewhere to stay? So there's a growing field of women that are entering gravel, but we still have a lot of room to grow.
Interesting. I did not know that Bentonville sold out in 4 minutes. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Announce it and they will come. I have a question about the age range of the riders. I know it's a race, but not everybody's there to actually race, meaning they know they're not standing on a podium at the end. What is the age range, and do you break it down into age ranges as people enter?
We will score an event based on age groups, but we don't let people in based on their ages. I think it's pretty typical across a lot of mass endurance sports that our biggest age ranges are between the 40 to 49 and 50 to 59 age groups. That's by far our highest age range, but we're seeing increasing growth as well on the younger side of that. So it's pretty low on the 18 to 25, but 26 to 39 is a growing market for us right now as well. But still staying true is the 40 to 55 range.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
That's terrific. Yeah. If Big Sugar is sold out, if the Utah race is usually sold out, Dirty Kansas is a lottery, so that's the only way you can get in. You're going to need to do more races, it sounds like.
It does sound that way, doesn't it?
Yep. And is that going to happen, do you think?
Yeah, I think, we're looking at what our portfolio looks like on a 5-year plan and are just trying to be very thoughtful in our growth, knowing we are a bigger organization, but this is also, we're really fortunate that we have the resources and means and support to be able to provide experiences, but we are just being thoughtful in our growth. We just acquired the Crusher and the Tusher event a few short weeks ago, and Bentonville was launched before that. So I think if we did anything more, we would be looking, 2 years down the road from now.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, would you tell listeners how they can find out about all of the races and all of the other things that Lifetime does?
Yeah. So if you were to go to our website, lifetime.life, you can see there all of the events that we put on. So Lifetime's a really interesting organization in that beyond events, we do have these clubs. And then within the clubs, they're a bit of a one-stop shop. There's, your typical fitness facility. And then we have a spa and a cafe and children's daycare and tennis and a pool. And we like to view it as a bit of a one-stop shop, almost like resort style gym, and that's based out of Minneapolis. But we do put on running events and triathlon events in addition to our off-road cycling and trail running. And you can find out all about that at lifetime.life. Right now, we're about 31 events deep in mass participation.
I really appreciate you taking time during the holidays to talk with me. I know it must be really crazy busy year end, but we'll look forward to seeing how the gravel races roll out this year in 2020. And thank you so much for talking with me. We've been talking with Michelle Duffy. She's with Lifetime Gravel Events. We've got Dirty Kanza. We've got Big Sugar, and we've got Crusher in the Tusher, which is hilarious. I love it. Thanks so much. Have a great holiday.
Thank you, Diane.
All right. You take care. Michelle Duffy is Director of Off-Road Events for Lifetime Fitness. For more information on the company, the location of their facilities nationwide, and, of course, the big events like Dirty Kanza and Leadville, you can log on to lifetime.life. Okay, one more short break, and then it's back to the East Coast to catch up with the East Coast Greenway's Executive Director, Dennis Marcados Soriano. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. 3 years ago, I was honored to become a member of the East Coast Greenway Alliance's advisory board. Since then, I've watched the organization in its relentless pursuit of connecting pieces of the trail that run from Maine to Florida, and I'm always delighted to be able to bring you an update periodically. Here's the East Coast Greenway's Executive Director, Dennis Marcados Soriano. Hi, Dennis. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist, and for our East Coast Greenway wrap-up show. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. It's great to be back.
We haven't talked for a long time. I would like to catch up with you and hear some of the highlights from the East Coast Greenway this year.
Absolutely. This is actually, in many ways, our best year yet, 2019. This is a record year in terms of investment in the Greenway. Almost $200 million flowed into planning, designing, and constructing new parts of the East Coast Greenway, up and down our Maine to Florida corridor. And on top of that, we actually have had the most donations yet, which is very useful because we also have the biggest staff we've ever had. So there's a lot of people that we're supporting now who are making such a big impact with the incredible volunteers that we always rely on, from New York City and Boston to Philadelphia, Miami, and right here in Durham in our headquarters in North Carolina.
We seem to measure the Greenway in miles and signage. How many new miles were added, do you know yet, in 2019?
Yes, so the new number is 30 miles, and that's a good number. But this is not just 30 random miles. This is now closing key gaps in the East Coast Greenway corridor, where even a half mile turns into a new 20-mile stretch where there are roads that people had to be on that scared them from cycling from one place to the next, and now they're doing it. And we actually ran through our numbers. We dug deep to understand how many people are using it. How many visits does the East Coast Greenway get? We are now at over 30 million visits per year. This is 30 million bike rides, runs, and walks on this 3,000-mile linear park. We have 1,000 of those miles of Greenway. That's where we're doing the bulk of these counts. And we're so happy that use has increased. So now that we're actually double, in terms of visitation, double the most popular national park in the country.
It's grown so much in the last few years. It's almost as if it's gained some sort of momentum, so it keeps feeding on itself. How many more miles were signed this year, meaning they actually say East Coast Greenway now?
Yes, it's over 150 miles were signed. And again, that's an important part of the experience. People like to be somewhere where they're sure where they are, not just that their phone is telling them they're on the at the right place, but the sign is also telling them that. And so it's been key. So now we have over half of the route is signed, turn by turn, and you know, getting people from city to city now. And we've got to focus on a few key states like Florida, Virginia, and a couple of others, and then we'll be fully signed for all 3,000 miles.
So you had several events, and I know there's one big one that you have each year. What kind of plans were made at this event that will carry forward into 2020?
Yes, we had our first ever Mid-Atlantic Greenways and Trails Summit. And so that happened in April in Philadelphia. 300 leaders from New York City to Washington, D.C., and then people from all over as well. But it was focused on that corridor. It was an incredible gathering. We rolled out a brand new impact report saying that if we invest just over $200 million to complete the East Coast Greenway in that region, greater Philadelphia, then that region will reap over $3 billion in economic, environmental, and health benefits.
Wow.
So the return on investment is amazing. And that's important because infrastructure investment is, it's full of big numbers. It's hard for us to understand because it doesn't make sense according to our pocketbooks and what's in our wallet. But when you add it all together, the amount of money that we're spending on infrastructure, it's really a drop in the bucket, and it has dramatic benefits that we all reap, all of us in society, because these are very accessible to everyone, from low income to everyone across cultures, all over the world. Visitors can enjoy the East Coast Greenway, and we're so happy that more and more people are.
Are we on target to complete the Greenway in the time frame you thought it would take?
Well, we can't just do 30 miles a year. I'm very proud that we got 30 miles this year. But we can, if we can continue to have this flow, we had almost $200 million invested in completing the East Coast Greenway this year. If we continue that investment rate through the next decade, then we can actually complete the Greenway by 2030. And that's when I want us to be the most popular park in America. Over 100 million visits. And those bike rides and runs and walks will be creating a much healthier 450 communities. It will be reducing emissions and helping to fight climate change. It'll be helping to adapt in communities because we'll establish linear parks that are floodable. You know, it's okay that we'll have more floods as long as we are preparing and we don't put the vital assets right next to the water where they're most risky. You know, so we have to get ready, and we're ready for that. The East Coast Greenway is a key part of the solution, and we're going to build a healthier and a more sustainable tomorrow. But we've got to dig in. We've got to work really well and be very strategic. And that's why in 2020, we're going to focus on our next strategic plan. That will be a plan looking forward to 2024. What can we achieve, and how does that get us closer to our overall goal of a healthy and sustainable and equitable tomorrow?
Well, you answered my question, which was going to be how climate change may or may not affect the Greenway. And in fact, it seems like it's the reverse. As climate change begins to affect our coastal areas, the Greenway is a way to still enjoy that north to south or south to north corridor and not be impacted by that. So it's year-end giving season here. I would like for you to tell our listeners how to find out more, not only about the Greenway, but if they're interested in getting involved or donating, how they can do that.
Thank you so much, Diane. It is really critical in these times. We do have a strong economy. And so let's take advantage of that. Let's invest in the best nonprofits all over our communities. The East Coast Greenway Alliance is one of those great nonprofits that's making an impact on important issues of the day. Whether you care about health, whether you care about equitable economic development, or you care about climate change and sustainability, safety for cyclists, you can invest in the East Coast Greenway Alliance, and you can know that your money is making a great impact and helping build solutions on all of those issues. So we would love to have you as a member and as a donor, and we'd love to involve you in our upcoming events. We'd love for you not only to give, but to get. If you commit to our New York to Philadelphia bike ride, which will be May 16th, 17th, it's our inaugural ride. We've never done it before. You could do that with us this coming year, and it's selling out fast, so I encourage you to register. And you can register, you can donate, you can get involved at greenway.org. Our contact information is there if you have any questions. And all of us at the staff and all of us as volunteers, we would love to work with you toward a greater and more healthy and sustainable tomorrow.
Well, Dennis, that was perfect. Absolutely perfect. We've been speaking with Dennis Mercado Soriano. He is the director, the executive director of the East Coast Greenway Alliance. And I guess for full disclosure, I'd like to make sure that everybody understands I am on the advisory board. I am proud to be there, and I'm always happy to be able to bring East Coast Greenway news to everybody who listens to the show. I wish you and your family a very, very happy holiday.
Thank you so much. You as well.
All right, thank you, Diane. We'll talk again.
Okay.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It feels really good to know that so much has been and continues to be accomplished on the East Coast Greenway every year. The route touches so many communities and so many lives in a positive and healthy way. I also think the environmental piece is a hopeful part of the efforts. For more information, and if you're interested in supporting the organization, you can log on to greenway.org. Thanks to all my guests this week. It's been a really fun show to produce. Next week, we're going to wrap up the year with Cycling Tips editor-at-large Neil Rogers, including his account of his Battle of the Mammals race with Jonathan Vodders. Please remember that you can always join the conversation going on all the time on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E, or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. If you haven't done so already, won't you please subscribe to our podcast at your favorite app, and maybe leave a comment, too. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe. Happy, happy holidays. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.